is the Freedom Fiends, and radio is dying, but we'll ride it down to the ground, whooping and hollering and waving our hat like Slim Pickens at the end of Dr. Strangelove. We'll show those dirty commies like Obama what we're made of in a display of primo pulchritude and rejuvenative radio waves, which will warm your brain to a tasty and toasty 365 degrees Fahrenheit to keep a sin flood of statism out of your head. Can you feel it, Megan? Can you feel it? Is it working, Megan? And can you feel it? Yeah.
Uh-huh. I can feel it. I can feel it. You can be the woo girl.
What's a woo girl?
Can work.
I don't know what that is.
The girl who goes woo at shows. I'm that girl.
Woo.
What's you a, know, what's a the end of every song? Woo.
Yeah, I don't know about these youth culture things. What's a holla back girl? I ain't your holla back girl. What does that mean?
I'm not actually sure. I'm familiar with the term, but I don't really know. But that's, I guess it's, it sounds like a booty call or something.
I know, thought like it was something like that. Like, you know, when you holler to her from your car, she's one that would holler back. Is that it?
Maybe. Oh, maybe that too. Maybe it's like a, yeah, I don't know, like a cat calling thing or something. I don't know.
Do you know the saying, there was an urban slang from the 80s when I was living in D.C., people would yell this. Urban youths would yell this at my girlfriend, the one I was talking about before the show, who kept the name and the gun. people are like, "What are you talking about?" But Megan knows. people would yell to her, "Hey, baby, can I go?" Which means, "Can I go where you're going?" Have you heard that? Can I go?
No, I haven't heard that. I just get like honks, or like people will like, I've gotten whistles or something before, but I don't really live in a city where catcalling is as much of a thing. Like, I live in a smaller place where I drive a lot, so like every now and then when I'm walking, like, you know, to places near work or something, you get like, you know, people will yell out, you know, moving vehicles at you, but it's kind of like, yeah,
you're one of the only people under 80 there, aren't you?
Probably.
Since it is in Florida. Yeah.
Ah, Florida people.
Florida man yells out window and
Florida man.
Florida man yells out window and breaks hip. And you know, the Freedom Fiends are the show that's kind of, we are cross generational. We're kind of where the hip meets the hip replacement, I would say.
I agree. No, that's a good way to put it.
Yeah.
It's a good range.
Yeah.
An age range.
And the Freedom Fiends is covered by a BIPCOT no government license. This allows reuse by anyone except governments. Learn more at BIPCOT.org. That's BIPCOT.org. So, MK, what's on your mind? What do you want to talk about tonight? We have a whole list of things. Or do you just want to, like, you know, shoot the breeze? Or both?
Oh, how about both? But you sent me something interesting.
What?
This article on Killology. And Killology. It sounds scary.
Yeah.
It sounds kind of evil, but it's...
Oh, can you get a degree in it?
It's just a study. is that what you joined the military for?
Well, there's colleges. There's actually a college in America called the War College. And it's where a lot of officers go to college to learn war. And it just sounds insane to me, but this is a thing. This is the world we live in. Yeah, Killology is
like the strategy part of it's interesting, but it's dark and weird to me still, you know? Like, it's hard for me to like just look at the strategy part of war, you know, and separate the strategy from, you know, the actions and the history of it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I learned about Killology from reading about video games, which is kind of a situation where there's simulation of killing that's kind of removed from reality. And it's actually kind of merged with actual warfare, because a lot of killing in war now is done in environments that are far removed from the battlefield and actually resemble video games in a lot of ways. Have you ever seen pictures of the bays where they launch drones?
Yeah, I have, and that's becoming a serious problem, too, as far as people abandoning, you know, flying drones. Even that's traumatizing for people, even though it's very detached from the situation. PTSD among people, the drone operators, is becoming a bigger thing.
Yeah.
It's becoming, the PTSD, deep. It's becoming a bigger thing in general, but also with these, you know, the people flying the drones. And it is like a weird detachment, though. I think it's almost scarier than having to fight someone face to face. Like, it's as far as what it can do to your psyche. Because there's that detachment. You know, you're not like, you don't have to look at the person you're about to kill face to face.
Well,
know,
and also
you're
most
doing it from a distance.
Most warfare throughout the ages, at least modern warfare with guns, the thing that the generals and the PhDs in warology and killology say is that generally when soldiers are interviewed about what keeps them going, it's not the political agenda, it's not following orders, it's the guy to the left and right of them. Like, literally, they're thinking about their buddy more than they are about themselves, and that's what keeps them fighting. And that's definitely exploited in how people are sent into battle. Now, in drone warfare, you know, which is like, they're not even on the same continent where the weapons are being dropped, where the missiles are being dropped from the drones. You know, a lot of it's done from Nevada, and it's done from, you know, our nickname for them is Dirty Cheeto Eaters, because they are murderers and they do have Cheeto stained fingers because they're basically playing video games in an air conditioned, really nice chair in Nevada and bombing people in Afghanistan and Pakistan. And I mean, if you look at the rooms that they make to put these men in, these men and women, these brave men and women, thank you for your service.
So brave, so brave.
Not really. Yeah, it's pretty much the most unbrave. It's far less brave than pointing a gun at someone who's pointing a gun at you.
It's cowardice, really.
Yeah, it really is.
It's complete cowardice.
And it does have psychological effects that are far, I don't know if it's worse necessarily than combat psyche, but very different in a way that hasn't really happened before, which is that they actually get to kind of know their targets in some weird remote way, because they actually, whereas in combat, people are usually shooting at, you know, a silhouette of a person at a distance or a person they can see the eyes of close up. With drones, they sometimes follow a person for 3 or 6 months, like literally follow them and watch them and can see their face and can see them playing with their kids and their dog and, you know, dropping their family off at the doctor and things like that. So they kind of get to know them, and then they kill them.
It's so creepy and so unnatural. I mean, war, you know, it's always happened throughout history. I don't view it as a natural occurrence, though. I mean, people are going to fight for things, but the level of warfare has really gotten just very bizarre. And the combination of drones with that is dehumanizing even more so. And, you know, as much as I do feel bad for the people coming back with PTSD, ultimately, I feel even worse for the victims of the drone strikes and people who, I mean, people in Pakistan live in constant fear of these drones that are hovering around them 24/7. Like, the hum of drones fills the air. Can you imagine living under that every day and just worrying that you have this, you know, that any day this robot from the sky can rain fire down upon you or your family? Or
it's actually,
I mean, it's terrifying.
Entering kind of popular culture to the point where, like, they're weaving pictures of drones into rugs that they're making. Do you know about that?
Yes. Gosh, it's just so terrifying to think about. And this killology article breaks things down pretty well. And it reminds me, so it goes into the four options a soldier has when they enter combat. And you don't get this as much with the drone side of things, but it's four things. It's fight, flight, posture, and submit. You see a lot more, it kind of goes into the different types of warfare you have too, whether or not people feel that there's like a moral obligation to fight. Like with World War II, a lot more people were motivated to fight because they thought they were fighting against this massive evil trying to take over the world. In other wars, that's kind of been reduced. And so fight or flight is obvious. That's what most people think of, you know, when it comes to fighting, you know, when it comes to a tense situation. Posture is kind of interesting. It's when the soldier is kind of faking active participation So their heart's not really in fighting. They fake it to kind of get through it. You saw this a lot in the Vietnam War and some of these other wars where there wasn't that kind of moral, you know, obligation to fight.
In the Vietnam War, there was, there were a lot of soldiers not hitting what they were shoot when they fired a bullet. And that's one of the main things with killology is the study of how to increase, you know, kill shots. There were a lot of people just shooting to shoot because their commanding officer was behind them and they weren't aiming at all because they really didn't want to be there and they didn't want to be shooting people.
Have you ever heard of the Christmas truce in World War One?
Yeah. Tell me about it.
Yeah. So this is interesting. So World War One was one of those wars too, where people didn't feel as much of a moral obligation to fight. They were sent off to war, but they didn't feel a strong connection to the causes of, you know, the beginning of the war, which was basically didn't involve the United States at all. So a lot of them, you know, they were doing this posturing thing. But in 1914, both sides, the Allies and the Axis side, decided to have a truce, and they would say, they sang Christmas carols. This was the, you know, on Christmas Eve
with the enemy.
With the enemy, they put down their weapons. They came out from behind the trenches, and they got together and they sang carols. And you know, for, you know, one day, it was a truce. There was no killing. And I mean, this happened in history. It's an amazing story to read about because, you know, for you get this glimpse of, like, if the soldiers just put down their weapons permanently, you know, that's where you could have this kind of peace. You know, they weren't taking orders anymore. They put everything down and they saw the humanity of the fellow person on the other side of that line that they were having to fire at. And you saw a lot of posturing too with World War One, a lot of them not necessarily firing towards each other, but past each other.
Powerful stuff, man. We'll be back.
You and the hamster in your brain are listening to Freedom Fiends with Michael Dean and his weird friends.
Are you sick of government lackeys who say, "You didn't build that"? Are you tired of elitists like Barack Obama and Al Gore taking credit for the web while trying to take over the web? Are you disgusted by experts whose concept of the internet is that it's a series of tubes? Take back the free market of computing by encouraging software developers to adopt the BIPCOT NoGov license. The BIPCOT NoGov license allows any use or modification except by governments. Go to BIPCOT.org. That's Bravo, India, Papa, Charlie, Oscar, Tango.org. Freedom Fiends, holding up a V for victory, or is it a peace sign, or is it a a cuss sign? So, peace sign used to be the V for victory sign. You know, there's actually a really famous picture of Richard Nixon on Air Force Two, which is the helicopter, the president's helicopter, standing on the steps of it, holding his arms up in the air, making what looks like peace signs. But it's not peace signs. It's V for victory signs. During the Vietnam War, those dirty, filthy hippies that we actually love, we like them more than we like Nixon. I don't know. I don't want to speak collectively. Do you like Nixon or do you like hippies more, MK?
I'm definitely more hippies. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, I thought so. I just don't like to speak collectively because then I get accused.
Thank you for that, though.
I get accused of having a mouse in my pocket. You know,
sometimes I'll side with Nixon over some things. It just depends.
I don't know what I'd side with Nixon over.
Nixon or Bush?
Really? Really?
No, actually.
I mean, that's kind of like, would you rather get kicked in the groin or punched in the throat? I mean, it's
one of those false choice things.
Yeah, and you're looking back on Nixon from history. I'm remembering Nixon on TV when he was president when I was a little kid. I don't like the guy. Yeah, man. Do you know that I wrote a letter?
They're all liars.
When I was 12, I wrote a letter to President Ford and told him to legalize marijuana. I've probably been on a list for that long. Yeah. Yeah. And he, you know, they sent me, they wrote me back. They sent a, you know, I think they actually sent an 8x10 glossy picture of him and a form letter that said that, you know, your concerns are very important to the president.
Yes.
Yeah.
Of course they are.
Yeah. So the two finger salute, you know, the, what we know as the peace sign was actually the V for victory sign in World War. Well, it's been since way before the World Wars one and two, it's been used since antiquity. There's a stone carving from the Greco-Roman era of somebody making it for, making the V for victory to chariot racers. But it was a campaign in 1942. It began the Belgian Minister of Justice and the director of the Belgian French-speaking broadcasts on the BBC suggested that Belgians use the V for victory as a rallying emblem during World War II. And then in Vietnam, I mean, Winston Churchill, there's famous pictures of him, looks like he's doing a peace sign. And, you know, he and Nixon are warmongers. They don't do peace signs. Mm-hmm. But the hippies kind of turned it around. I like that they made it, you know, something different. But it's also, in the United Kingdom, it's the same as flipping the bird. Now, mm-hmm. if you do it palm inwards at someone and kind of like push your fingers up in the air, which sounds like some sort of examination being demonstrated. So yeah, you got more thoughts on that, or do you want to talk more about killology? This is related to killology and PTSD.
It is. Oh, I really am glad that they took that symbol back.
Yeah,
you know, it's hard to do that with some things. It doesn't always work trying to take language back or take symbols back. But yeah, they took it back, and we were talking about PTSD earlier, and a lot of studies are pointing towards this increase in PTSD since World War II. And one of the theories is that there's less decompression time after conflicts now. Before, people would have, you know, weeks on a boat coming back, you know, from overseas to kind of decompress with the people around them who experienced the same traumatic events. Now you get shipped on a plane back, you're back with your family after experiencing all this war stuff, and you haven't had the time to process it.
And you're not.
And that causes all sorts of problems.
And they're not always shipped back with other people now, or if they're shipped back with other people, mm-hmm. you know, on the helicopter. And literally, it can be like 48 hours now from Afghanistan back to Cleveland. And it was, you know, 2 weeks to a month from World War II and the Korean War, because, you know, they were coming back on boats, and they generally needed to be, you know, put in a hospital to be watched to see if they had any infectious diseases coming back. And the testing for that is so much more immediate now that it's not needed that time, you know, being segregated away from polite society. The other thing was, during World War II, when people were in the Korean War, when people were shipped back home, they were generally not only, you know, taking 2 weeks or a month to get back, they were with people that had been in their unit. And now mm-hmm. it's basically, you know, you're with a couple strangers in a Huey and then a transport jet, and then you're back. So we'll be back.
Arms. We'll be back.
I'm making a peace sign for victory.
You're listening to Freedom Fiends with Michael Dean and his weird friends, tasing you with liberty since 2011. Learn more at freedomfiends.com.
Hey, there's some Squiscar Squiggles from Death Clocks. And you are listening to the Freedom Fiends on the, you know, the radios. And I guess I says worms now, so there you go.
You've read books, attended lectures, and you know the Constitution well enough to know it's a well-crafted blueprint to create an ever-increasing federal empire. But there's still one thing missing.
Buttons!
Freedom Fiends now has buttons. You'll get State Speech is Hate Speech, Guns and Weed, Buy Sheep for Sheep on Sheep, and two designs for the Freedom Fiends. Wear them with pride. Use them to start conversations with statists.
It's only $10 for 10 buttons, including shipping.
Go to freedomfiends.com and click on the link at the top that says Buttons.
What does freedom mean? Tune in to LRN.FM to find out. LRN.FM is the Liberty Radio Network, a collection of live talk radio and podcasts, all coming from a principled pro-liberty perspective. LRN.FM show hosts aren't left, right, or conspiracy kooks, you can tune in 24/7 to LRN.FM via your phone, computer, satellite, and more. Listen free anytime at LRN.FM. That's LRN.FM.
Freedom Fiends. Controversy arose during Steve McQueen's Mexico trip because McQueen sought a non-traditional cancer treatment called the Gerson therapy that used coffee enemas, frequent washing with shampoos, daily injections of fluid containing live cells from cows and sheep, massage, and Laetril, an ineffective anti-cancer drug from Mexico. Ah, that's too bad, man. Steve McQueen was awesome. We were just talking about him a little bit during the break. You don't know much about Steve McQueen, do you? He's before your time, huh?
I don't know much about him, no.
He's the king of cool, man.
Nice.
he was a really kind of understated, really handsome action figure actor in the 70s. And as you just discovered, he was the highest paid actor at the time. But I like him. And he liked guns. Guns are good.
Guns are good, yeah.
Yeah. So we're talking about PTSD. And I guess this is kind of segueing into members of the military who go in all gung-ho and then actually experience combat over a period of weeks, months, and years and come out of the military not quite so gung-ho. You know, it's really easy to be a war hawk, to be someone who's never been to war, who sits on the sidelines and says, go over there and kill them. And that is, that's a hawk, man. That's someone, a lot of politicians are like that. It's a lot of politicians and a lot of right wingers who are totally pro-war and not only never served, but actually went out of their way to get out of it. Rush Limbaugh went out of his way to get out
of it.
George W. Bush. Let's see who else. Ted Nugent. There's a whole mess of them, man. A lot of the loudest people for Mitt Romney. I have a friend that got out of the Vietnam War in a really interesting way. He wasn't even trying to. He actually, and the guy is a total liberty guy now. He's a friend of mine in Wyoming, Paul Bonneau, and he. He joined the Marines. He was a Marine and he joined the Marines before the Vietnam War and was stationed in Hawaii running the computers over there, like the early, you know, war computers for the Army in Hawaii. And when the Vietnam War started, everybody else was being drafted, but they don't draft Marines. You know, Marines are people that generally want to serve. And so there was no shortage of Marines going, I want to go over there and kill some gooks, you know, from his unit. So they had enough and they needed him to stay and run the computers because he was the only guy that knew how to do it.
Oh, wow.
So he spent the Vietnam War surfing in Hawaii. Nice work. Nice work if you can get it.
It's best possible scenario there.
But he wasn't trying to get out of it. He was like willing to go, but they were just like, no, you're smart. You're staying here.
There you go. Yeah, it is interesting because right after 9/11, there were so many people who were like, yeah, send them to war. Let's go to war.
Well,
a lot of them were older people, too.
A lot of people signed up, too, though, like, you know, that
right.
week. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And but I've known several people who you know, were all excited about signing up and then saw what it was like and did a total 180 on their beliefs about it. Or I've even known people who didn't change their beliefs immediately afterwards, who came back and were still pro-war and were still like, no, you don't understand because I was over there and you don't understand what these people want to do to us and all that, and had, you know, pretty intense arguments with people about it, who have eventually turned around and started just reading more philosophy and just understanding more about it. And unfortunately, a lot of these people had to deal with something like PTSD that caused them problems in their interpersonal lives, and they realized what they were losing. And it's so horrible to have to go through war and then have something like PTSD as a result of not being able to cope with it and not having the time to process it and or even realize, you know, if that was time that was, you know, well spent in your life. Do you rush into something and then realize what a mistake it was, because there were people who were intentionally misled into war too. I think people really have to keep that in mind, especially with the Iraq war. I mean, it was completely premised on a total lie, a lie that's been proven to be a lie. So these people, they were lied to and motivated to go into war.
It's not just the Iraq war, the Vietnam war was a false flag. And the premise for going into the Iraq war is that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction, and you know, later it was shown that he didn't, and Dick Cheney and George Bush and people around them basically said, oh, sorry, we got some bad intel. So they've never really admitted that it was a false premise to go in. But the Vietnam War, it's fact that it was the Gulf of Tonkin. It was a total false flag, the reasons to go into that. I mean, that's not disputed. That's the government doesn't even dispute that.
Right. And it's so horrible because government can come out and say, oopsies, we made this mistake, but people died and there's no consequences for the people who were killed as a result of their lies and or just omissions of basic facts. And yeah, I mean, you know, what do you do with that? Like, it's, you know, this is why things like antiwar.com exists. This is why, you know, I think it's important to tell people as often as possible, like, look at what your taxes are supporting. Look at, like, really the horrible things your taxes are supporting. I mean, yeah, everyone thinks, you know, the roads and stuff like that. But, you know, you really have to consider war at the end of the day when people talk about things like taxation or service. I mean, the idea of military work being service is kind of disturbing to me. You know, I don't feel that they're serving my interests.
Yeah.
But
yeah, it's tough coming out against this stuff. I mean, there are people that, you know, everything from we'll kick you off the radio station to, you know, we'll try to kill you. An interesting thing too, like whenever.
But isn't this what they're fighting for?
I know. That's the interesting thing. Like, I've seen so much hypocrisy with, like, on the social networks when somebody says something against the idea of war. And generally I think they make the mistake of saying things against the troops. And I don't like to do that because I feel like a lot of people who end up serving in the military of any country are kind of tricked into it. And there are people who are in service who would hear me say that and hate me for saying that. They're like, I wasn't tricked. I joined because I had to. But an inordinate number of people who join, it's either some combination of they were lied to and told that there is this enemy and that's what you're over there fighting, which is generally not what you're over there fighting. You're generally over there fighting for Wall Street. And the other thing is the poverty draft. I mean, Nixon got rid of the draft. It was the smartest thing a tyrant could ever do because most of the people who were anti-Vietnam War were basically against them or their boyfriend getting drafted. And once they got rid of the draft, 90% of the protesters just evaporated. And there was still the core amount of people that were anti-war and actively protesting it. And a lot of them were not hippies. A lot of them were clergy, nuns, priests, rabbis, and, you know, members of churches and congregations who had a moral, you know, religious imperative against it. They kept battling against it. But as soon as Nixon got rid of the draft, they, you know, it was gone. But so a lot of the opposition was gone. But basically that created something that's been called the poverty draft, which is that over, you know, the last five decades, the economy has been wrecked, possibly intentionally, but if not intentionally for this purpose, at least it's a, you know, it's a good result for the government. For military recruiting is there are a lot of people, I would say, you know, some double digit percentage, like 10 or 20% of Americans who have really no option, like economically, you know, they are so economically, I don't even like the word disadvantaged, but they're just so poor and have so little options for training and skills to get out of their rut that the military looks like an amazing opportunity to them.
Most of the people that I know who have gone into the military have gone for that reason, because they didn't Same know here. What to do after yeah. school, or they felt that they were aimless and they needed something to do, or you know they were forced into it, and it was horrible. I remember just being horrified seeing the recruiters in my high school. That recruiters are allowed in public schools is just so sick to me, because they target poor kids too. There are a lot of kids in high school who, you know, they're struggling in school because it's difficult to focus in something like public schools sometimes. So they're struggling at home. They know that maybe they can't get into college because their grades are bad. And these recruiters come along and say, well, don't worry, we'll pay for you to go to college. You just need a couple years of your life to us and everything will be taken care of. And it's really sad because, you know, a 17-year-old kid isn't in the right mindset to, you know, be killing anyone or be, you know, engaging in any kind of warfare or be making decisions like that to sign away their future for something like that.
And, but they're actually in the perfect mindset to serve the purpose of the killing machine, because people who are older have a little more life experience and are more likely to say, why would I do that? You know,
it's predatory. Yeah, it's absolutely predatory that they target these kids. And I don't care if, you know, you can support the troops and all of that. I get it. I know a lot of people have family members in the military, but you don't have to support them going into the schools and targeting the children. I mean, that's just, I think it's appalling. And, you know, I think that they should be, you know, able to make that choice as an adult who's looked into it more. And, you know, but yeah, it goes back to, you know, the poverty problems, like the root causes are, you know, the problems that still exist economically.
And not just that, but the fact that America is kind of set up now to discourage entrepreneurism. You know, like even if you can get it together to borrow or scrape together some money to start a business and you have a good idea and a good head on your shoulders and a lot of drive, it's so hard to start a business now and comply with all the regulations and taxes and hiring practices that a lot of people just don't want to do it. And it's actually kind of looked down upon in a lot of places. It's like that in Europe too. I was even more so when I was doing a show with the Scottish couple. Have you heard them yet? Dan and Katie?
Yeah. Oh, they're awesome. Yeah.
They really are. And there are two of our newest co-hosts, and they said that in Scotland, you don't have to fill out income tax. They just take your taxes out unless you run a business. So, like, basically, they make it even that much more of an easy thing to not work for yourself. They don't want you to, you know?
Oh, wow.
You're listening to Freedom Fiends. Go to freedomfiends.com to help keep it drone-proof. Creamy Radio Audio. Want caviar sound on a cat food budget? Creamy Radio Audio by the Freedom Fiends has great free tips so you can sound like a pro without spending like one. The most powerful form of human communication is one person speaking to another. But if people have to suffer through your sound, they'll change the channel and miss your message. With articles on microphones, preamps, recorders, mastering, recording remotely over the internet, doing a podcast, even getting a show on actual radio, the Freedom Fiends show you what they use and where to get it. Whether you're a talk show host, voiceover artist, podcaster, evangelist, or just want to record your loved ones for the ages, at Creamy Radio Audio, the Freedom Fiends will help you make the most of your sound. Creamy Radio Audio will help you speak to the world with sound that will make people want to keep listening. Check out creamyradioaudio.com. That's creamyradioaudio.com.
Yeah. Freedom Fiends. I want to give a shout out to Mike Peter, who is listening to Freedom Fiends. In Sarasota, Florida, 106.9 FM. He says, cool to hear libertarians on actual radio. Now, I think it would creep me out if I were him and I posted this and then heard it on the radio. It'd be kind of like,
well, we're creepers.
The radio is talking to me. Have you ever seen that? God, what was it? There was some, It might have been the guys from Tenacious D, Jack Black and what's his name, but
Kyle Gass.
Yeah, it might have been them, or it might have been somebody else. But doesn't somebody have a skit where like the band is stalking one of the fans, where it's kind of a switch?
Oh yeah, that sounds so familiar. Yeah. Yeah, that sounds like it might be a Tenacious D thing.
Yeah,
yeah. I've seen a Portlandia sketch about like kind of an obsessed fan. I don't know if you watch Portlandia, But yeah, there's a good one with, oh my gosh, I'm forgetting her name. She's on SNL.
Yeah.
She's in Walk Hard.
Anyway.
Oh, she's so funny. But yeah. So, yeah.
What is it? What is it? You're burying the lead. What is the skit? Ruin it for us. Tell us.
Oh, yeah. So it's this band called Catnap, the two main characters in Portlandia. Catnap. And they have a cat as like their third band member, and so they're backstage after the show and they're getting ready to pack up, and then this other woman comes in who's like their biggest fan and she's obsessed with them, and she like pulls out a gun to like kidnap them and the cat too, like so they can be her band forever because she followed these other bands and they abandoned her and got famous. And it's the woman who on SNL, she's so funny, and she was on Walk Hard, and her name's on the tip of my tongue.
I don't know what that is.
Duh. Can't think of her name.
So we've invited Ian Freeman to Fiend Phone In to call in on Fiend Phone and talk about his unmilitary recruiting at high schools. And if he doesn't Fiend Phone In, and he can just interrupt, he has the magic credentials to do that. He has the what did I call it? Our equivalent of the emergency alert system. I tested it the other day with Derek J. Did you hear that? He was doing a show and I just jumped on Fiend Phone and started talking.
Yeah. Oh, I can't think of the name.
Yeah. It's Furries, the Fiend Phone Unnecessary Random Reeducation Interruption.
Oh, yes.
Fiend Phone Unnecessary Random Reeducation Interruption Exigency System, or Furries. Yeah.
Are we changing the meaning of furries now?
Well,
taking it back.
It's just a backronym. It's memorable. Yeah, we're taking it back from those freaks. Those furry freaks. Yeah. I like the idea of furries, but it doesn't appeal to me at all.
I'm okay with them doing their furry thing.
Yeah. Although I must say there's something really touching to me about attractive women who wear cat ears as a lark. I've always thought that was pretty funny.
I have fluffies, the fluffy legging things, and I never got one of those. I know the hats you're talking about. The spirit hoods is what they're called. I know this because I went to festivals, but yeah, the cat ears are like the ones with like the things that come down. You put your hands in them, and hippies wear them. Like the new, yeah, like festival.
Don't know what that is. I'm
but,
old,
but I have several pairs of fluffies that are like these furry looking. They cover your calves, but they're called fluffies. And
I guess we're done talking about the war because this is more fun. I'm actually smiling now. I haven't smiled the whole show because we've been talking about war. We're declared.
And what is it good for?
Nothing. Absolutely nothing. And it's WSRQ in Sarasota, Florida, which is one of our, I don't know, 8 or 9 affiliates on nighttime shows. We're on like 32 stations. It keeps going up and down because occasionally we add a station and occasionally we lose a station. And we generally don't lose a station because, you know, they don't like something we said or something. We generally, when we lose a station, it's generally because radio is dying. And radio, like, not all radio stations are as hip and happening and together as WSRQ in Sarasota. A lot of them are like, oh, we forgot to program you when we switched over the satellite receiver. You haven't been played in 3 weeks. Sorry. We'll get to it in 4 months, you know? Yeah. We'll be back for hour two of the Freedom Fiends Libertarian Re-education Musical Extravaganza with MK Lords and myself, Michael W. Dean, after this trip to the free market.
This show survives on donations from fiends like you. We put that money back into our show and Liberty Outreach and donate most our ad space to Liberty organizations that make a difference. We're also a teaching hospital, educating the next generation of Liberty talkers on the skills needed to keep the radio flame of truth burning into the future. Put your money where your heart is and make a donation of any amount to the Freedom Fiends. Please go to freedomfiends.com and click on the spinning coin on any post.
Hey.
This is the Freedom Fiends.
Broadcasting through the Libertarian Reeducation Center's low orbit ion cannon. High atop Financial Beast Plaza, on the artificial satellite LibPair 2017 in the Alpha Centauri region, at Intergalactic Prairie Studios is the name of the location where MK Lords and I are sitting together in the same room. And the Freedom Fiends is covered by a BIPCOT no government license. This allows reuse by anyone except governments. Learn more at BIPCOT.org. That's BIPCOT.org. So MK, what do you want to talk about? You have a plan, you have a plot, you're scheming. What you got?
Yeah, let's talk about hierarchies.
Yeah. You sound excited. Yeah.
Yeah.
Should I put on do I need to put on my Maslow hat here?
I'm going to do my Howard Dean. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I was doing that a lot.
I miss that guy. Whatever happened to that guy?
I
he was fun.
I used to around the time that happened, I used to introduce myself on the show as, "This is Michael Dean, no relation."
Aww. He had spunk.
Yeah, he was a spunky little communist, wasn't he?
He was a spunky little
He's a Vermont Democrat. That's kind of like a Soviet conservative or something, maybe. I don't know.
So politics and hierarchies. So there's this thing called negative selection. And I was saying on the break, this kind of reminds me of like the phenomenon of what Joe Biden is. Like, where did this guy come from? Like, oh God, like it's Joe Biden. So what negative selection is, it's a political process that occurs in especially rigid hierarchies, most notably dictatorships, but also to lesser degrees, such as corporations or electoral politics. And it's the person on the top of the hierarchy, wishing to remain in power forever, chooses his associates with the prime criterion of incompetence. They must not be competent enough to remove him from power. So this is hiring people who you think are less intelligent underneath you so that they can't, you know, collectivize and, you know, have a coup and get you out of power. Or, you know, maybe even in the event, look at the presidential situation with Obama and Biden. It's like, where did he come from? He's embarrassing. I mean, it's like, don't let him out in public. I mean, don't let him keep getting these pictures taken groping women and all of this stuff. And it's like, you know, Obama has to stay in power because we're stuck with that guy, you know, if anything happens.
Who's this we? You got a mouse in your pocket there,
you,
Megan?
You, them.
Not me.
They, them, those. It's funny because they talk about this in mostly to do with dictatorships, but the presidency is a rigid hierarchy, too. I mean, and even Congress, too. I mean, it's the whole thing. Is a hierarchical structure. And yeah, I mean, it's a way to kind of keeping certain parties in power too. I mean, I'm very curious.
I think that I think they've figured out the, I'm not one on the conspiracy theory of there are elites, you know, 12 Jews running the world or any crap like that. I don't believe that, but I do believe that there are people that are vastly in power that we've never heard of. I believe there are people who we've never heard of or barely heard of who probably don't even have websites who can tell Barack Obama what to do, who can tell David Cameron what to do, and they'll listen. And
yeah, these people aren't on Facebook or Twitter.
Yeah, they're not on Facebook or Twitter, and they probably don't have offices in America, and they're people who really honestly don't care whether Republicans or Democrats are in office in America or whether, you know, Labor or Conservative Party is in power in the UK. And I think that those people have figured out how to rig the game so it really doesn't matter. You know, I mean, it probably mattered 50 years ago to these people to their dads, you know, who were probably running it then, you know, who was in power. But it really doesn't matter now because they've basically, the Democrats and the Republicans are pretty much identical, except for a few tiny things like maybe gay rights and maybe abortion. But other than that, everything else is the same. Basically, it's become...
They want the same methods.
Yeah. It's become them against us. You know, it's become the parties against the people to the point where it's almost a one-party system like you'd have in Iran or North Korea or China. Although it's kind of interesting because they still let you have a longer leash to the point where you can go on government-controlled radio and call them fascists and say things like, Barack Obama is a liar, he is a socialist, and his feet stink. And if you think Jeb Bush is going to save you from that, if you think there's a difference between Jeb Bush and Hillary Clinton, I think they're the same person. I think they're shape-shifting reptiles. No, I don't. But they're ostensibly the same person. They might as well be, as far as their Soviet globalist masters pulling the strings go.
Yeah. Well, what this phenomenon does is it also explains why government is so incompetent, because they literally want the least competent people below them. And so, you know, a lot of people do believe in the overarching conspiracy and everything's controlled. Oh, it would be easier if it was, right? Like, I wish it were that way, you know, but these people have no clue what they're doing and they can't even barely carry out the politicians. Look at Hillary Clinton, hubris, like the recent email scandal with her, for example. Like,
who cares?
Obviously flaunting. But it's funny though, because it just shows the lack of which she cares. I mean, it's just so obvious at this point. She's like, whatever, I can get away with anything I want. Yeah. Like, no one's gonna stop me, kind of thing. But yeah, I mean, there are incompetent people around her. I mean, she strikes me as one of the more competent evil ones, but there's a lot of incompetence because of what power is and why, you know, people wanting to preserve their own power in the hierarchy.
You know, I said in passing to my friends, I was not on radio then, but when Bill Clinton, you know, got it on with some curvy chick and got in trouble for it, which I think was the least of his sins to the point of not even being a sin. I mean, I think that's between a husband and wife. It's not a national issue. And, you know, people saying things like, oh, this proves he's not an honest man. I'm like, an honest man wouldn't do what he did, which was distract the news by bombing an aspirin factory. You know, he murdered people to get the news cameras off him. That's a much bigger crime than, you know, getting a little strange on the side. But when that happened, I said to my friends, you know, they were surprised. Like, you know, I had friends who were Democrats. And they're like, I can't believe she let him get away with that and just stood there silently. And while he apologized and had crocodile tears and, you know, why is she pretending to be such an old fashioned prudence good wife? And I said, they're going to pay her back by making her president. I said that at the time in what, 93 probably, or 95, something like that, 96. And I didn't even really like study politics then. That was just the first thing that popped into my head and it seemed to make sense. And I think they're going to.
She is shrewd, man. She has been playing this game for a really long time. And
the man has
become
she's a
woman. Even more hawkish than Bill was. I mean, if you read a lot of, you know, during the Clinton administration, you read, you know, what was going on behind the scenes with her. And I mean, even when she was Secretary of State, she was so much more incredibly hawkish than the other people were around her. She was the one who was really like, we need to go in there. We need to, I mean, calling Obama, you know, basically a coward for not going into Syria sooner, you know, it's all out there. I mean, all out there. It's amazing.
If you wanted proof or evidence, at least, of what professional wrestling politics really is, think about, not a lot of people remember this, but go back to when Obama was running for president before he was nominated, and he was basically running against Hillary for the primary. Mm-hmm. Those two were scathing each other in public. I mean, they were saying things that you can't take back. And then as soon as he was, you know, shortly after he became president, he appointed her Secretary of State. That's the level of just puppetry and professional politics and professional wrestling and how it's all the same thing. And I do want to clarify something that when I said, I realized that something I said early in this segment kind of seemed contradictory, but I want to explain it. I said, I don't believe in these globalist theories of, you know, there's six men running the world secretly from some bunker in Belgium or something. And then I was talking about elites who probably can tell Obama what to do and George Bush what to do. And that sounds kind of contradictory, but the difference between what I believe and what a lot of people believe who believe there's actually some kind of like Illuminati thing going on. I don't really believe that there is, you know, a bloodline of people going back ages. I just believe that power corrupts absolutely, and there will always be people who want to influence the aura of power. And I believe that there are people who are doing this. I believe that there are people who are so wealthy that they make Bill Gates look like a pauper, whose trillions of dollars are immeasurable by normal standards. It's not something, you know, here's the thing, like nobody has $1 billion in the bank. You know, people that are billionaires, it's not in banks. It's in trusts and it's in ownership and it's in influence and it's in, they can make a phone call and get the law changed in some country. That's the kind of wealth I'm talking about.
Well, yeah. And power is hard to measure in currency. So
yeah.
it's really difficult to
measure. Well, I mean, Obama's
a person's power by their wealth.
Obama's only got, Obama's only got like $5 million and most of it he got from book royalties, but he has infinitely more power than most private businessmen who have $5 million worth of assets. Okay, go ahead.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I was going to say there's a good Frank Zappa quote about this. Politics is the entertainment division of the military-industrial complex. I mean, about it. This stuff with Hillary and this stuff, all of the stuff that we're going to see coming out with the primaries, it's theater. I mean, it's all just theatrical craziness. I mean, I think if you look at it from that angle, it's much better for your mental health if you just step back and you just laugh at how idiotic it is instead of getting wrapped up in the who's going to win and who's debating and who's going to win the primaries and we have to vote. We have to vote for anyone but Hillary or anyone but Bush or anyone, you know.
Florida man anyone runs but for stuff president.
Scares me.
Jeb Bush, man.
Florida man runs for president. That is the headline. Someone please like write that. I'll write it or something.
Florida man.
But Florida man runs for president. Florida man elected president if he wins.
Well,
he gets
paid back.
All.
He gets paid back for swinging those votes when they were counting chads down there.
Right.
Yeah. Don't forget that, man. All right.
Never forget.
Never forget. Freedom Fiends, we'll be back. And it was Tenacious D. It was a sketch called Lee, the stalker sketch. Yep.
You're says listening to Freedom Fiends. So much truth, it hurts.
Are you tired of your taxes funding endless occupations around the world? Antiwar.com is run by people who understand that wars abroad become wars at home, wars on our freedoms. Antiwar.com is dedicated to bringing you the latest in news, views, interviews, and reviews from the top movers and shakers in the anti-occupation movement. Antiwar.com has it all, from thorough foreign policy analysis to interviews with whistleblowers who used to run the military-industrial complex. Antiwar, pro-free market. That's Antiwar.com.
Freedom Fiends, squatting for liberty. So what were we talking about during the break? Do you really want to? I want to go there.
You know what? Let's go there. I think we should go there.
We're going to go to Frank Zappa, but in a really roundabout way. You were talking about this device.
We'll make it to Frank Zappa.
That they make for ladies so they can pee standing up like a man.
All right, but it's not about that. Okay,
it's not a feminist thing.
No, what it is, it's a convenience thing. It's just a practical thing. Because if you've ever been camping or at a festival or something, and you're a lady, and there aren't public facilities of some kind, it's really uncomfortable. You know, being in the woods and all of that. And so there's this device you can get that makes it easier, so you don't have to do the squatting thing, because the squatting thing is uncomfortable and weird and like
weird.
It's just inconvenient and freaky, right? I'm trying to find the name of this thing. It's basically a device that would allow you to stand up and, you know, do your business in a more convenient way.
I gotta say, there's something very freeing about doing that. And here's the creepiest thing I've heard in a long time. Or seen in a long time. In Europe.
It's called Go Girl.
Go
Girl. So it kind of is feminist.
Yeah, I knew it was.
Or Shiwi.
Like,
there's one called Shiwi. Oh, I like the Shiwi one. That sounds great.
Here's the creepy thing. A lot of places in Europe, including anarchist squats, this is what's kind of mind-blowing to me. There are pictographic signs on the wall in bathrooms telling men to sit down when they pee. That is really emasculating and creepy and globalist to me. I mean, I asked them about it and they said, the anarchists, lefty anarchists in the squat, I was showing my movie in, and one of them, and they said, oh, it's for, you know, it's so you don't pee on the seat. And I'm like, I don't pee on the seat. I lift the seat. I don't pee on the seat. I don't pee on the rim. And they're like, you must use this. You must use. And here's the thing, like some of these squats, they intentionally took the door off the bathroom in some kind of like, I don't know, gender neutrality or not having, or privacy is bourgeois or something. I don't know what the reason was, but I actually had men, emasculated anarcho-communist men, come in and tell me while I was peeing that I should sit down when I pee. And I actually said this to one of them. I said, I'm an American. I pee how I want. And they hated, that, man. But yeah.
So that's so funny. I wrote this article on my blog called The Real Feminist Solution to Potty Parody, and it was kind of making fun. There was an article in Time Magazine.
Potty parody?
I kid you not.
Did you say parody
potty
or parody?
Parody.
Equality.
As in equality. Yeah. But there was an article in Time Magazine that showed up called The Everyday Sexism of Women Waiting in Public Toilet Lines. So I propose a solution of like, we abolish like men's rooms so that like women don't have to wait in line anymore. It's satirical. But this was a real article. And it's insane. Like it's insanity. The equality thing, the forced equality thing is just not good.
People wonder why I don't leave my house much.
Well, and Frank Zappa has a good quote about that, bringing it back around to Frank Zappa. So communism doesn't work because people like to own stuff.
And the reason we were talking
about... And they like to be free, and they like to, you know, no one should tell you how to, you know, do your business.
The way we got to Frank Zappa and to pee, well, we were going to talk about Frank Zappa, and I mentioned that I was turned on to Frank Zappa when I was 12 years old by a millionaire who liked to pee, save his pee in jars like Howard Hughes. Now, that sounds really bizarre and mind-blowing, but here's the story. My sister was married for a very short period of time to a millionaire who, his dad was like, I don't know, an attorney for the mafia or something. His dad was into something. But the son had become a hippie, back-to-the-land guy who wanted to, you know, give up his father's, I don't think he gave up his riches, but he basically like was like, I don't want to take money from you. And he and my sister went and lived in this really broke down house with an apple orchard on it, on the property in West Virginia. And I really liked this guy. He was really cool. I didn't know he was a millionaire until they got divorced. And the coolest thing about all this is that when my sister divorced him, he had given her a wedding ring that was probably worth $100,000. It was a diamond the size of a baby's eyeball. I mean, it was big. And when they got divorced, she gave it back to him. She was like, she wasn't one of these, like, I'm going to keep what I got. She was like, okay, we're done. Here's your ring back. I don't want anything to remember you by, which I had a lot of respect for. But this guy, they didn't heat their, they had wood heat for their house. So it was pretty cold a lot of time in the winter. So he would just pee in jars. So he had a bedroom full of jars of pee, and turned out he was a multimillionaire. So he turned me on to Frank Zappa, though. We'll be back.
There you go.
You're listening to The Freedom Fiends, and I'm beaming these words into your cerebellum.
For some reason in this country, and most of the Western world, it's okay to just judge.
Hey, this is Michael Dean from the Freedom Fiends radio show. Computer programmer Derek Slopey and I have created FiendPhone. I'm using FiendPhone right now to talk with and record one of my co-hosts in real time. Take it, Davi.
Hey, this is Davi Barker, and I'm 1,000 miles away from Michael, but we sound like we're in the same room.
We sure do, Davi. So, Davi, please tell the nice people more about FiendPhone.
FiendPhone is free, no-gov software that opens up a global world of possibilities for collaborative, high-quality, remote voice media production, and I'm digging it.
People can try FiendPhone right now at FiendPhone.com, but we're also raising money to vastly improve FiendPhone and vastly improve independent talk media worldwide.
So go to FiendPhone.com to help out. Who will build the audio roads? We will, with your help.
That's FiendPhone.com, FeenPhone.com, Foxtrot, Echo, Echo, November, Phone.com.
FiendPhone, I never knew remote audio could be this good.
Freedom Fiends. I was just taking care of business during the break, and I did not use a jar. And I was standing, because I'm an American, and I was looking out the window. I opened the window in the bathroom. I was looking at the moon. It looks really beautiful. And I was looking at some stars. And I was thinking about how we are broadcasting into space. Because when you're syndicated on radio, the way it works is we connect over a dedicated internet line to our network using FiendPhone to connect to each other. Go to FiendPhone.com. And the network sends it to from Minnesota. Let's see. You're in Florida. I'm in Wyoming. The network's in Minnesota. The satellite uplink is in Atlanta. So they send it to Atlanta and it goes up into space, hits a satellite, and then is rebroadcast down and radio stations pick it up. And this all happens in less than a second. Like you, if you're listening on radio, you're hearing this less than a second after we're saying it. But the uplink going up to the satellite doesn't just go to the satellite. It leaks past the satellite and into space. And it's my hope and my dream that the possibly habitable planet in the Alpha Centauri region, 4.3 light years away, will hear the Freedom Fiends and say, "We've been monitoring this planet for 100 years, and this is the first sign of intelligent life." And they will come down here and make me the libertarian emperor of the world and give me their state blocking technology and or invite me to choose who I want to bring to their planet to get away from tyranny. And that's the plan.
So they might have like this one ring that would give you all of the power.
No, it's actually going to be something more like, not 3D printed, but more like 11D printed, 11 dimension printer that will enable them to like kind of tesseract so it doesn't take 4.3 years for the signal to get from them to me. I think as soon as they get the signal from our first shows almost 2 years ago, so we're talking about like 2.3 years, they'll hear us. I don't think it's going to take them 4.3 light years to get the technology to us. I think it'll just be like on my desktop when I log on one day. So
there you go. That's so I'm fixated. Like I got to know, like going back to the gutter, I have to know why was this guy peeing in jars? Like what is really the mysterious reason why? My mind's in the gutter.
My mind's in the stars. And you're still in the gutter?
It was bothering me.
That is so bathetic. Do you know what bathos is? It's an elevated sweep from the sublime to the gutter in art, generally.
Oh, I'm all about that. Yeah.
Pretty much all the art, music, literature, and film that I enjoy is bathetic. Queen. The band Queen is a really good example. Led Zeppelin, Pink Floyd, Nick Cave. Queen. You know, the collected works of Chuck Palahniuk. Yeah, it's all good, man. Mm-hmm. And the TV show House of Cards, both the American and the British version, but especially the American version. All right. So, you know, before we get on to, I don't want to answer your pee question, but basically I will. I don't want to answer it, not because I'm creeped out by it, but because where we left it sounded weirder and cooler than the reality. It makes it sound like I was related to Howard Hughes, but I wasn't. It was more like he just was lazy. You know, so he'd pee in jars in bed because he didn't want to get out of bed because they lived in a cold house that had wood heat. The fire would die during the night. And he didn't want to get out of bed and freeze, so he'd pee in a jar, and just he, you know, had forgotten to empty them or didn't bother emptying them. He had 7 or 8 or 10 of them in the house, in his room, in their room.
There you go.
All right. So, you know, when we were talking about negative selection, one thing we forgot to mention that's related, negative selection is the top-down encouragement of incompetence in any hierarchical organization, whether it's private or public. And there's a related concept that's kind of the opposite, the same effect, but from the opposite direction, which is the Peter principle, which is the concept that in a hierarchical organization, people rise to their level of incompetence and stay there. And what that means is that people are doing a good job, they get a promotion. They're doing a good job, they get a promotion. They're doing a good job, they get a promotion. And they get to the point where they're doing the best job they could and they're where they should be. But instead of keeping them there doing a great job, they get promoted to a higher level where they can't really do the job very well, but they're so high up in the organization, they can't get fired for it. And this is a real thing, man. And if you want to look at non-hierarchical options for running organizations, especially ad hoc temporary organizations, you should read my book, A User's Manual for the Human Experience. And you can Google that. I'll also put it in the show notes on Freedom Fiends when this will be up about a half hour after the show's over. And it's a book I wrote. You can buy a copy paperback on Amazon, or you can download a free audiobook or PDF. And it's something I wrote as a labor of love. I make a little money on it, but you don't have to pay money to get it. It's free. And it basically takes the 12 traditions of AA and applies them to organizations that are not committed to recovery from substances. Have you read it?
Nope. I haven't gotten a chance to yet.
Man, but you should. Speak up. Talk like you're on radio, please.
All right.
Yeah. All right. So you want to talk about Frank Zappa.
The Peter Principle thing is... Oh, yeah. We can talk about Frank Zappa,
No, let's talk about the Peter Principle.
Okay. Let's talk about the Peter Principle. Yeah, okay. Okay, so I've definitely experienced this, and you know, the Peter Principle is something, like, I've worked in restaurants and stuff, and you have these, like, I've had the experience of having these really horrible, like, managers that they couldn't get fired because they'd been there for, like, 10 years or something. You know, they were there at the beginning, and they just are so wrapped up in there, but they're horrible, like, at their job. But they have this, like, attitude about it, too, so even though they're incompetent, they still have, like, that kind of middle manager ego, you know, control factor. Like, they have, you know, they have just enough power to have control over other people, but not quite enough to, like, really have complete control. And, you know, and they're just not suited for the job. So, yeah, and I'm wondering to what degree the Peter Principle influences that kind of egotistical attitude of, like, someone knows that they're not great at their job, but, like, they still have power over other people, and they know they can't get fired. So it just, yeah, I'm wondering if there's some relation there, basically.
Yeah. Yeah, it exists in pretty much any hierarchical organization, especially ones that are not aware of it. And there was a book called The Peter Principle that was a business management book. It was kind of one of the first business management books. I mean, there were stuff back in the 20s and 30s, you know, more about, like, self-help and how to win friends and influence, how to win friends and scam people. But it was kind of the first, Peter Principle was one of the first modern of that genre that, you know, fills whole bookstores now, of, like, business management, business secrets of the pharaohs kind of stuff. Yeah. And it's something that if managers and, you know, management is aware of, it's less likely to happen. You know, they're more likely to not promote someone to their level of incompetence and instead say, hey, you're doing a great job right where you are. Let's keep you here and, you know, add on some perks every year you stay. It's the smart thing to do.
Yeah.
It's the right thing to do. All right. So you want to talk about Frank Zappa? Frank Zappa? Yeah. Frank Zappa?
Frank Zappa. Yeah. Well, he's got just some really great quotes, you know, about music and life and politics. And I want to read two in a row, because if you haven't heard his music or, you know, read much about his beliefs, it kind of sums up his personality. So the first one is, you can't always write a chord ugly enough to say what you want to say. So sometimes you have to rely on a giraffe filled with whipped cream.
What? Say that one again, please. please.
You can't always write a chord ugly enough to say what you want to say. So sometimes you have to rely on a giraffe filled with whipped cream.
Oh, he's talking about his stage show. Yeah.
His stage shows. Yeah, which were so over the top and absurdist. And even his music, too. He had these crazy sound effects. He was really a pioneer of sound effects and, you know, weird stuff in music. Like real absurdist kind of jazz, but also like sometimes rock opera type stuff. But it, here's another one too. And it kind of, I think of the Fiends when I think of this quote, and he says, "I never set out to be weird. It was always other people who called me weird."
Yeah. I definitely never set out to be weird. When I was younger, I admired a lot of people that were weird, like Syd Barrett.
Yeah.
And it's kind of one of those things, if you have to say you are, you aren't. I've kind of come to grips with the fact that I'm weird and that this radio show is weird and that most of the media I produce is weird. But what I try to do is just be myself and make the technical aspects of whatever I'm doing so good that you can kind of do whatever you want. And that's really important. And I think a lot of people don't really take that into consideration. Like there's a lot of music that's like Daniel Johnson is a good example. Like he's really weird and he was mentally ill. I'm not mentally ill. I don't think it's cool to be mentally ill. Like, you know, I think I've been around people who are mentally ill and it's not cool. It's a really kind of disturbing thing. I've been in bands with people that are mentally ill and it's not fun. It's not cool. It's not interesting. It's not weird. It's just painful. But a lot of people that are weird, the technical aspects of their art isn't very good. Like Daniel Johnson, you know, most, a lot of it's like recorded on a cassette in a bathroom. It sounds horrible. And I don't know. I would have thought that somebody, you know, people liked him a lot. I would have wished that somebody would have liked him enough to actually put up some blankets and put up two mics and check the sound levels before they recorded this guy who was definitely going to die at some point.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's something that Zappa was good about, was the production quality of his stuff.
And he was anal about it.
So finicky about it. Yeah.
He was a control freak about it. I mean, he was one of the first musicians to build a comprehensive home studio and not just do it as a tax write-off. Like a lot of people did that as a tax write-off, but he actually did it, you know, in the late 60s and kept building on it and stayed in the same house in Laurel Canyon for decades until his death, to the point where it was, you know, beyond any state-of-the-art studio, commercial studio. And he was kind of a, in his later years, he was kind of a windowless bunker kind of guy. Like he just, and especially since when he knew he had cancer, like he just kept recording. They're still releasing new Zappa stuff. Mm-hmm. You know, he didn't, he kind of eschewed social, you know, he wasn't a party guy and he just stayed home and made great art because you only get so many turns on this big blue ball, man. You got to make it count. And I think that leaving it's something true. Important and well done, a body of work, is more important than attending the latest parties.
Worms.
You're listening to The Freedom Fiends, an invigorating alternative to those other shows.
Hey, this is Nathan Explosion from Death Clock, and you're listening to The Freedom Fiends on the radio. Worms.
Yeah. Freedom Fiends. Redemption in the third act. And we're going to talk about not really out-of-body experiences. I said that during the break, and our board op jumped in and said, "I'm reading about out-of-body experiences." And I'm not actually talking about that. That was poor wording on my part. What I want to talk about is the feeling that you're watching yourself from outside yourself, which some would conjecture is an actual out-of-body experience. I don't think it is in my experience, but I'm talking more about, I know that sometimes when I've been extremely angry in my distant past, I don't really get extremely angry anymore, but I would have this kind of feeling like I was outside of myself. And it kind of can go along with fight or flight stuff. when you're in a life-threatening situation. Like an example I can think of, this wasn't angry, it was more, I don't even know if it was fear, but I got mugged one time and got a knife to my throat in New York City while purchasing narcotics on the street back when I did that. And I really wasn't aware of what was happening. And it was very quick. It happened very quick. You know, it was probably 60 seconds from the time the guy walked up to me till the time he walked away with my money. But it kind of felt like I'd just seen something in a movie. It didn't really register that it had happened to me. And another experience I used to have a lot when I was younger was dreams, recurring dreams, where I'm driving a car, but I'm in the back seat of the car watching myself drive it. And usually there's somebody mm-hmm. else in the front seat talking to me as the driver. Do you ever have experiences like this, Megan?
Yeah, I've had a lot of dreams like that, especially when I was younger, a lot of recurring dreams like that where I was able, and I still do from time to time, where I can detach from myself in the dream. But I've had it happen in real life too, and it used to happen a lot more when I was a kid. You could even compare it to disassociation, and a lot of people think of like something like dissociative identity disorder or something. It's but that feeling of disassociation is kind of what you're talking about. And I used to get it when I was a kid. I'd completely lose track of where I was and what I was doing and even who I was for a second. Like everything seemed foreign around me. It's really hard to describe. And then I did get it the last time I seriously felt this kind of outside of yourself feeling was when I got into a car accident when I was 18.
Yeah, me too.
I got hit. I got T-boned on my side and the airbag went off in my face and kind of, I guess, briefly knocked me out or something. I don't remember, but I remember like hearing myself screaming like, but like I didn't come back into my body for like a few seconds. And then I realized that that was me screaming, but like I came back, I guess, to consciousness and I heard screaming. And then like, I realized that, oh, that was me screaming. I ended up being okay, but it was really traumatizing. And that's exactly what it felt like was I was out of the situation and then I came back into it. Very disassociative and kind of eerie, very eerie.
The first time I had a hallucinatory experience, I was 5 years old, and I had mono, which is really bizarre for someone to get that at 5 years old. And no, nobody was kissing me. You can get mono without kissing people. I got mono. Some other people in my school had it, too. I got it from sharing a glass, most likely. But I think a teacher had it, as I remember, it turned out. But I had a fever of 103. And had to be rushed to the hospital. And I remember feeling like I was outside of myself watching it. I also have a memory of, I have a really early, really distinct memory that's absolute. And it's being like a baby, like a toddler, you know, still in diapers, able to talk a little bit, but not really complete sentences. What age would that be in general?
Maybe like 2 or 3.
Maybe. Okay. I have a memory of my parents being gone, having a babysitter, and her having a pot party in my parents' house. And I remember having my diapers changed on the kitchen table with a bunch of kids standing around, teenagers standing around smoking pot. And it's not a recovered memory. It's not even a harmful memory. It's just a memory. I remember what the babysitter looked like even. I remember.
Wow.
Yeah, but it kind of, that memory is kind of like as if I'm watching a movie of it.
Yeah, I have memories like that, yeah. The brain's amazing.
Brains. Good. Good.
Brains.
It's been a really good show, MK. Thanks for yakking with me.
It was a pleasure.
Worms. And we have at least one listener in Florida. I like that.
Yeah. Woo.
They say for every person that writes you, there's 1,000 people listening. That's what I've heard.
Huh.
There's 1,000 people in Florida. 1,000 weirdos who are up too late. Into space.
We're all weird.
Yeah, we are. Yeah, you tricked me into saying I'm weird after saying I don't like saying I'm weird. Was that intentional?
A little bit. It's on the record now.
Yeah. Well, we're still recording. I should edit it out, but I won't. I'll leave it in and talk about how you tricksters messing with my head. All right, cool show, man. Worms.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
It was great. I really enjoyed it. So fun stuff, man. That was really fun.
Worms.